Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon's virtual podcast. I'm Jeffrey James Higgins. My wife Cynthia and I own Elaine's Restaurant and Literary Salon in Old Town Alexandria. We've made it a literary hub for authors in the DC area. And I believe our guest today is number 153 or 154. I'm losing count at this point. We're reaching out to South Carolina for today's interview. Brian Thieme is the author of The Mudflats Murder Club, the first book in the Mudflats Murder Club series, as well as the Detective Matt Sinclair mystery series, which includes Red Line, Thrill Kill, and Shallow Grave. In his previous life, Brian spent 25 years with the Oakland Police Department, much of it working homicide, and he retired as a lieutenant. He's also an Iraq War veteran, retiring from the Army as a lieutenant colonel after 28 years of active and reserve service. He holds an MFA in creative writing and is a member of the Mystery Writers of America, Sisters in Crime, International Thriller Writers, and the Island Writers Network. Brian lives with his wife, Yellow Lab, and Tonkinese Cat in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, where he's also a member of the Sheriff's Department's cold case team, consisting of retired law enforcement professionals from around the nation who examine unsolved murders. So, Brian, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
That's quite a background you've got there. Let's start off. I just got to ask you, like, this cold case thing. It reminds me of Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch, right? Have you read that series?
Oh yes, very much. And then I saw the last season of Ballard with the with her cold case team on the TV. I mean, it was wonderful. Anything by Michael Connelly is great.
Yeah, and he's a super generous author, too. I'm sure you probably met him at Thriller Fest or some of these conferences that you go to. Do you find when you see something like you mentioned watching Ballard, when you've seen it first or you've read it first, is there a difference when like you see the different media adaptation of it? So if you've read the books first, are you disappointed when you see it on TV? Or if you haven't seen it, do you find you like it better when you see their adaptation?
Well, you know, just about all the time I read the books first, and I've been reading Michael Connelly ever since, you know, his first Harry Bosch came out. And I got to say, you know, when I saw the Ballard on TV, I was very, very impressed. You know, nothing against the Harry Bosch stuff, but I tell you the truth, I think that series was better than some of the Bosch series.
Yeah, it's hard to adapt to, right? Because you have, if you look at a script, especially if for television or if it's shorter, not like a feature film, you're looking at like a 10% or something of the actual words that you can use in it. So you really have to change it. I think that's why personally, when I've read something and loved a book and then it's turned into a movie, I'm often disappointed because I've already had that movie in my head, you know, and it's not the same. Sort of the magic of reading, right? You're that connection you as an author have with your readers when they see something. They're creating their own unique version of that movie or just basically guiding them.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
All right. So listen, why don't we start? Tell us about your new series. You have book one that's out. What's it about?
Well, you know, a little introduction, you know, I always like talking about the main characters. So, you know, the main character on this one is a guy named Sean Tanner, and, he spent a 30-year career in law enforcement, most of it working homicide. And then he and his wife retired and moved to a retirement community on Spartina Island, which is a barrier island on the coast of South Carolina, which some people might say resembles Hilton Head. When Sean moved down here, he had kind of promised his wife that he would be spending the rest of the time just with her, you know, because she took care of the family and everything else during all those times when he was working homicide. And after he was here, his wife died of cancer. And for the next year, Sean was floundering. His only purpose in life was a lousy game of golf and catching fish and releasing them back into the tidal rivers until there was a murder right across the street. And, the sheriff's department asks Sean to come in and take a look at the crime scene. Now, at the same time, there was a sheriff's department cold case team with a bunch of older retired law enforcement people from around the country, and they asked Sean to join the team. It was nicknamed the Mudflats Murder Club, based upon the first homicide that they looked at, which was a body that was in the Tidal River in the Mudflats. And as they're looking at the newest cold case, the Mudflats Murder Club sees a connection between that and the murder across the street from Sean's house. The second main character is Charlotte Charlie Nash, and she is a sergeant in charge of a detective squad there on Spartina Island. Charlie is a cross between a Southern belle and a badass detective. And she and Sean end up butting heads because, you know, the Southerners just don't like these Yankees coming down there and thinking they know everything about police work. But together they end up working together. And I won't tell you what happens.
Yeah, please, no spoilers. I mean, it's been well reviewed and it looks terrific. So I'm sure our listeners will want to pick up a copy of this. So I get this all the time as an author too, but people always ask like, you know, oh, is this character you, or how much do you believe in it? But there are some parallels obviously between this character and yourself. So how much of it is you in this character?
Well, you know, the background of, you know, my law enforcement career, and, you know, I worked for the Oakland Police Department. And since I know something about that, I had Sean Tanner work for the Oakland Police Department. And after I retired, you know, first I lived in Connecticut for 10 years where my wife's family's from, and then we moved down here. So there's a little bit there. And I do live in a, we don't call them retirement communities. We call them active adult communities. So I do live in one of those here. And I am a volunteer on the sheriff's cold case team. But Sean he's smarter than me, better looking, and a whole lot better detective than I ever was.
I notice he's kayaking in the beginning of the book. Are you a kayaker down there?
You know, funny story. When we lived in Connecticut, my wife and I both bought kayaks, and we were always out in the rivers and the lakes and everything. And when we moved down here, we brought the kayaks, and you know, most of the kayaking is done in the tidal rivers, which of course is salt water and opens up to the ocean with some pretty significant tides. Now, occasionally, you know, where I live, there's a dock, you know, just a quarter mile from my house where you can launch kayaks from into the river. And occasionally, alligators, which are freshwater lovers, will go into that tidal river. And so my wife said, we will never, never, never kayak in that river. So actually, about 2 years ago, we sold our kayaks.
Are alligators actually a threat down there for people? Do they have incidents?
Well, they are, you know, and just about every time when there's an incident, it's because either someone stepped about 2 feet from one of the ponds where the alligators are, or they were walking their dog right up at the edge of the pond and the dog ran in and the alligator went after him. I found, and as long as you're 10 feet away from the edge of the water, the alligator ain't going to come out and get you.
Are you a bad golfer too?
Yes, I am. I take pride in, you know, the guys I play with, we say when we golf, we only have two goals. And that is having fun. And if you don't have fun, it's your own fault. And not getting hurt, you know. And as we get a little bit older, we don't want to rip our backs out, twist a knee or anything. And then one of my old military guys says, well, we don't want to leave any men behind. So if you take four people out in your foursome, you have to bring all four back from the battlefield. I mean, the golf course, rather.
I feel like you guys have set a pretty low bar for this. You all want to come back uninjured. That's great. So how many books have you written so far?
Well, how many have been published, or how many have I written?
Both. How many have you written and how many have been published?
Four books have been published, three from the first series, the first one in the Mudflats Murder Club series. I've completed the manuscript for the second and third book in the series, and I'm working on the fourth one.
Oh, congratulations.
And then there's two other novels that are sitting in my computer files.
Were those your first novels?
No, as a matter of fact, after my first series wasn't continued, and I know as an author, you've experienced this yourself. I mean, I was really dejected that they didn't want a fourth book in my first series. And my wonderful agent does what good agents do. She says, write something new. And so I did write something new. You know, I mean, it took me a year and a half to put it together and everything. And my agent tried to sell it to the publishing houses and nobody was interested. And she said, again, write something new, which I did in the same story. And then she said, okay, right now, they're not looking for any books where the cops are heroes. So write a standalone with another main character, which I did, and nothing happened. And then we went back to that one, which is now the Mudflats Murder Club. And she said, you know, you need to pick up a book called The Thursday Murder Club and read that. And she goes, I don't want you to copy it, but read that and make a couple changes, a rewrite. And I did. And that sold the Mudflats Murder Club.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's good advice to always go back and write the next thing. There's so many vagaries in the market. And there's decisions. Like I talk to publishers, I talk to agents, you know, and their decision to represent something or to purchase something, to acquire something and get behind it can be based on so much that has nothing to do with the author or the story or the quality of the writing. You know, it can be what else they've acquired recently, what they're looking for, what you know, acquiring editors are specifically looking for at a given time, and books that they don't want to compete with the other authors in their stable, et cetera, right? So it's that I think it's a good psychological tool for writers to just keep themselves sane and also do what they do best. You know, if you spend too much time in the writing and then the business part of it, I think you'll just drive yourself crazy.
Yes. And that's always been my feeling. You know, I do the writing and I have a wonderful agent and she takes care of the other side.
Who is your agent?
Paula Manier with Talcott Notch.
Oh yeah, I know her. We co-moderated the back room with Hank Phillippe Ryan. Yeah, she's terrific. And she's, is she Bruce Coffin's agent as well?
Yes, she is. As a matter of fact, you know, just a quick story. You know, when I was in my MFA program, they brought a number of publishers, agents, and other people in. And one of those people they brought in was Paula. And so I met her when I was in my MFA program. And for some reason, she took a liking to me. She said, hey, when you finish your thesis, which is a publishable novel, I would love to be the first one to read it. But then backing up, she invited me to come up to Crime Bake, you know, the conference up there sponsored by Mystery Writers of America and so on up in outside of Boston, and do a presentation. And this was before I even had a book out. And I did a presentation in front of the whole crowd, you know, a couple hundred people, entitled Writing Authentic Police Characters. Not that I knew anything about writing at that time, but I knew what an authentic police character was. And then the second year I was there, Bruce Coffin arrived. And of course, him being a retired cop, me being a retired cop, you know, right away we hit it off. And I said, hey, you know, you got to meet my agent. And I introduced him to Paula. And so that was that.
Oh, that's great. Because mystery and thriller, they're such popular genres, you tend to get a lot of people who don't have any experience in the field. When you're at a place like Crime Bake, like how much of a sense do you get that other authors are doing inauthentic things in their work or unrealistic things that would pull the reader out of the sort of a fictional haze that they're in?
Oh, boy. I mean, all the time. You know, it was interesting when I did that presentation there. You know, I mean, of course, one of the people sitting in the front row that you mentioned, you know, Hank Phillippe Ryan, who, you know, is just a wonderful, very, very generous person. And after that presentation, they had another thing that, you know, I forget what they called it. You know, it was kind of a little round table. So, ask the expert. You know, so I was in another big room sitting at a big round table, you know, and I was the so-called cop expert. And the table, you know, 10 other authors could come and sit there. Well, you know, they had 10 people in those chairs and they were stacked up two behind because they all wanted to ask me questions. You know, and I think that, yeah, a lot of the authors that have never done this, they get their police expertise by watching TV and stuff. And some of it's really, really, really bad. I mean, you carried a badge and gun for a living, I mean, also, so you understand.
You call yourself a so-called expert, but you spent a lot of time and you're still doing it professionally. I interview people from all walks of life, and it's really interesting how what your career becomes your normal. And I think sometimes people don't give themselves enough credit for how much they know, especially after over a long career in whatever, you know, discipline that they've been studying. What are the things that you see the most in fiction, whether it's television or in books, that writers are getting wrong?
Oh, you know, I mean, sometimes it's just the physical part, you know. I mean, I don't know what detectives in every city wear today. But, you know, when I worked in Oakland, you know, the homicide investigators wore suits and ties. You know, we didn't wear blue jeans and T-shirts. You know, maybe detectives some places do that. You know, we never would drive our personal car. And I see detectives in TV and movies all the time driving their personal cars because it's kind of sexy to drive a Mustang or a Camaro. But, you know, in the real world, you know, when I was on homicide call out, I had a take home car, you know, one of the old Crown Vics. And, you know, I would drive that to the murder scene. I would never dream of driving my personal car to a murder scene. And then the next week, my wife taking it to the grocery store, you know, so, I mean, those kinds of things, you know, of course, we can talk about guns and stuff. I mean, writers have known for the last 10 years that Glocks don't have safeties on them. But still, you know, you've got the cops in books, they're clicking off a safety. You've got cops getting ready to go into a house on a high-risk search warrant, and they rack around into the chamber of the semi-automatic. I mean, you know, my gun always had a round in the chamber. I would never think of putting it in my holster, you know, without a round in the chamber. So, I mean, some of those things. But I think the biggest thing, and I think, you know, where my experience helps with my writing is I understand how cops think, you know. You understand how cops think. And sometimes I read novels where there's a police character and he's more like a male character in a romance novel that just happens to be carrying a gun for the day.
What specifically, like, in how cops think, do you think is missing there? Is it the black humor? Is it like the attitude they have towards the people that they're investigating, or what is it specifically that's missing?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I think some of that is that black humor, you know, the gallows humor. You know, I mean, when I was working homicide, it was before the days where everybody had a cell phone and had a camera on you. So when we were at a murder scene, as long as there was no media nearby, I mean, we could say or do pretty much what we wanted. And, you know, and some of that dark humor, the gallows humor, I mean, it's for the sanity of the detectives and the officers. You know, you get a young officer that's, you know, out there at a murder scene with three dead people and blood and guts all over the place. You know, we allow them to joke about it. You know, it's better than them going off and sitting in a corner and crying over it. So I think that's part of it.
How do you see writers in a lot of common fiction and, you know, even in the movies, addressing like the psychological aspect of it that you're just talking about there? Because, I mean, you do this in your books and in the, you know, showing them as real humans that actually have to deal with things and create a type of professionalism as a defensive barrier or whatever, but you're still dealing with the actual gravity of the situation. How often do you see it when people don't do that? You know, when cops turn to, they become very shallow characters, very black and white.
You know, I see it quite a bit, you know, especially when, you know, the detective character is a secondary character, you know, or when someone tries to write the detective character as the romantic link to their main character, a female character. The cops are human. I mean, you know, we have all the same human problems that anybody else does. And I think for a rich story, some of that has to be included. You know, sometimes it becomes stereotypical, where every detective is an alcoholic suffering from PTSD, divorced 3 times, you know, blah, blah, blah. Now, part of that, you know, there's some reality there, you know, but I think sometimes they go to the extreme of giving him or her too much baggage.
So I want to just hear a little bit about your career. What else? Because you don't come out of the academy and become a homicide detective. So where else did you work in the police department?
Oh, wow. You know, coming out of the academy, like everybody, I started in the patrol division, you know, and I worked in patrol answering radio calls and, you know, as I say, arresting bad guys, for a couple years. And then I was selected to go into what we call the special operations section. And that was a team of one sergeant and 12 officers that worked street enforcement. And we worked all the high crime areas going after the major felons. Every day was high speed chases, you know, pulling your gun and that kind of stuff. From there, I was transferred to Vice Narcotics, where I'll say for the next year and a half, you know, I grew my hair long, grew a beard. And for a year and a half, I bought drugs and picked up prostitutes for a living.
I'm sorry. How long did it take you to become a detective in homicide?
Okay. So from there, you know, I got promoted to sergeant. And back then in Oakland, all the felony investigators were sergeants. So I got promoted to sergeant. And I was right away assigned to the criminal investigation division. And I worked auto theft for 6 months, which everybody starts off at an auto theft or burglary. Then I was transferred to the felony assault unit, where that's the investigations where we investigate the cases where people were shot, stabbed, and beaten, and they survive. And from there, I was selected to go into homicide. You know, at the time, I mean, I'd been on the department now for 8 years, and I was the youngest guy in the homicide unit. That was always my dream job, you know, working homicide. And I was amazed that I got there as soon as I did.
Yeah, that's incredibly fast to get into a homicide unit because, I mean, rightly so, they're the most serious crimes, and it's the, you need the most professional experience to get there to be effective in it. Why was it that you always wanted to be a homicide detective? Like, what was it that drove you to want to do that?
Well, like you say, I mean, that's the most serious crimes, you know. It was one crime that in a big city like Oakland, there's so much crime, and sometimes people get numb to it, but no one really got numb to the murders. People cared about the murder cases. A little bit of gallows humor. You know, I can say it was also the only case where when you finally solved the case and went to court, the victim didn't get on the stand and go sideways and ruin the case. Because, of course, your victim's dead. So you didn't have to worry about a uncooperative victim at the last minute. But yeah, you know, and the other thing is, because it was a serious crime, we had, you know, the best people working there. We had all the perks. I mean, and sometimes the perk was just, you know, whenever you filled out an overtime slip, it was signed, it was never questioned. So, I mean, we could work as much as we wanted and we got paid for it.
Was there one case in homicide that stood out to you above the others?
You know, I mean, none in particular. I mean, I investigated a couple with serial killers. I had 2 triple murders. I had a very high clearance rate for the unit, probably, you know, over 70%, which is good. Wow. for a big city like that. But there were some cases I never solved. Some cases I never solved, and some of those I still remember. One of the, you know, years after I was retired, I was living in Connecticut, and I got a call from a investigator with the DA's office. And he said, hey, I'm calling you because one of your old murder cases, that was 20 years old at the time, was just solved, and we're going to need you to come back and testify on it. And I mean, I was thrilled. It was a woman who was stripped naked, lit on fire, and hung from a tree in a city park. I did everything I could and never solved it. But then 20 years later, with the advances in DNA, they sent the rope back to the crime lab, and a couple of skin cells were there sufficient for DNA, and they matched it to a man who was in custody on a rape up in Oregon.
Was it somebody who was known to her?
No. No, when I went back and looked at my whole case file, the name never even popped up. He was very much a sicko. When, homicide investigators and a DA investigator went up to Oregon to interview him before he was extradited. And he admitted everything. And he said, the woman was a prostitute, says, prostitutes ruin lives and they should not be allowed to live.
How much do you think about these suspects when you're creating fictional characters?
You know, I can't help. In my current series, and even my first series, I didn't take any actual suspects and plug them in. In my second novel, Thrill Kill, I did start off with that same scene with a woman hanging from a tree, murdered. But every suspect I make up myself, but I've got a lot of experience with it. The literally hundreds and hundreds of hours that I sat in interview rooms talking to murder suspects, and they're all different. Everything from the 16-year-old drug dealer that, killed another drug dealer on the street corner because the guy stole his bag of potato chips from him and it was a matter of respect, he had to kill him. The serial killers and the very methodical ones. So I've got a lot to draw from when I devise a killer.
So you're in South Carolina, you're playing some bad golf. Why do cold cases now? What drives you to do that?
Well, when I moved down here, right away I joined what they called the Low Country Retired Law Enforcement Officers Association, which has about 150 retired local cops, federal agents, from all over the country. And mostly, we get together once a month for a meeting. They have a cigar day, you can go smoke cigars, they have breakfast. And it was more of a social thing that I did it for because I wanted to connect with local law enforcement down here. And they found out my experience and they had an opening on the sheriff's cold case team and invited me to go over. And I thought, this is something I can do, a way to give back to the community, use some of my expertise and maybe help. And of course, when I needed to come up with a new book, I was sitting in one of those sessions that we had. And, because my agent says, come up with something new. And I go, wow. I think I've got an idea,
Do you, when you're writing a book, getting back to like this series, do you start with character or does the idea come to you as a plot, like a what if?
Well, in a series, I think the character comes to me first. Because with a good character, I have all kinds of murders I can draw from. In my first series, that was it. I came up with a good character, and every book starts off with a fresh homicide. Now, of course, the detective's life continues, and he grows and falls back and grows and so on. And the same thing with here, with a Mudflats Murder Club, I started with a premise, What if there was a cold case team? And I didn't want to use a real location, so I made up Spartina Island. What if there was a cold case team? What if a retired homicide investigator moved here? And he was asked to join the team. And I needed to create something very, very sad about him. So I had his wife pass away. And then have a murder across the street to kick off everything. You know, and of course, then a female detective from the sheriff's office, which could potentially be a love interest. You know, that's always good.
So you start with basically high concept for the series, and then you populate with characters and have the, but you get that there has to be the internals. So there has to be like the familial connections and things that make the characters attached to the plot, right? To up the stakes.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, and with, you know, my detective, Sean Tanner, as I said, when I started off, his only purpose in life was a lousy game of golf and fishing. And then there's a murder across the street. Well, you know, Sean, even with his wife gone, he's finding purpose in life again. You know, and I think a lot of retired people can identify with that, you know, after an exciting, interesting, important job, and all of a sudden they're retired. Now, what do? You know, well, they don't have to investigate murders, but, you know, there's a lot of very purposeful things that people can do after they leave their careers.
So when you've got the general idea of the situation, but when you're creating the character, the protagonist, and the other main characters, how do you start with somebody you know, or do you build the whole thing from whole cloth? And walk us through your process a little bit and how you populate them with flaws and characteristics.
Well, you know, with my main character, Sean, you know, as we already talked about, it was relatively easy. I mean, you know, I know what a homicide detective is. I've never experienced, you know, the death of a spouse, but living down here in an active adult community, I know plenty of people that did, and I talked to them at length, you know. So what's a person go through when their spouse dies? You know, and then when I created Charlie Nash, you know, I had a female character in my first series. And before I created her, I talked at length with two Oakland police investigators. One of them was retired at the time, and the other one was working in the homicide unit at the time. And I really wanted to know, hey, what's the difference? You know, what's the difference between a man and a woman doing this job? And I found some striking differences, you know, a lot of very similarities, but, you know, a lot of striking differences, you know. And I, you know, one of my heroes, Rachel Van Sloten, I mean, she's retired from the Oakland Police Department now, but I mean, she had an incident with, as a young officer, where she was out there in the streets and had formed a perimeter around where they're searching for a bad guy. And the bad guy comes out and she gets in a knockdown, drag out fight with him, almost loses her gun, but eventually survives. But I mean, her face was all busted up, broken bones and everything else. And it took her 2 years to get back to work. And everybody, you know, from the city physician on down wanted to retire her. But she came back because this is what she does. She's a cop. And eventually then went to work homicide. You know, so, you know, when I create my characters, I try to really get into them. And the same thing with Charlie Nash. You know, when I created her, hey, I ran her by Rachel and another female. I said, hey, is she realistic? You know, because I want it to be authentic here. So, you know, in the Mudflats Murder Club, it's a bunch of other old people. You know, one of them is Frank. He's a 80-year-old retired NYPD detective. Then there's Phoebe. She's a woman and she's a retired FBI agent. I've got Beagle. He's the legal Beagle. He's a retired prosecutor. You know, and all of these guys have interesting personalities, you know, and so there's a little bit of humor in it, but all of these people are experts. I mean, they're all law enforcement professionals, and when things need to be done, they get them done.
I think there's a real lesson for writers, of somebody with all your experience in law enforcement, and yet you still reached out to people to ask some specifics. What were some of the differences between a male and a female in law enforcement?
Well, I don't know if it's so much true now, but you know, when I first went into the homicide unit, there had never been a female investigator in the unit. And I think a large part of that, you know, the roles were still a little bit different. We had female officers and stuff on the department, but you know, it was easier for the man to, you know, when he gets called out in the middle of the night, when, you know, he's working for 3 days straight, when he gets a murder during his, you know, son's birthday party, he went and took care of the homicide and the wife took care of the family. No women at that time wanted to work homicide because of the crazy hours. And, you know, basically that was your life for the years that you were working there. And then, like, for instance, when Rachel came onto the unit, she was married to a sergeant on the police department. And her husband agreed to transfer into the training division so that he would work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And he could take care of all the family stuff. But Rachel told me, you know, she was torn up when, you know, she's out there investigating a murder on Christmas morning and she can't be there for her kids opening the presents. And she talked about that. She talked about that to the other guys. You know, when I was in the unit, the guys might have been feeling that, but the guys sure didn't talk about it. So I think that was one major difference, you know, there.
So did you have other difficulties in writing female characters?
No, you know, 90%, I mean, 90% of the way they work is the same as the man. The male and the female detectives are both professionals. But I also have some wonderful beta readers, and Rachel has been one of my beta readers forever. And, you know, I remember one of my earlier books, you know, and she says, my first main character, he also had a female partner. He says, "You have Kathy Braddock crying way too much," you know? And so that was a good point, you know? And quite honestly, I mean, Rachel was probably the only homicide investigator I ever saw cry on duty. You know? But she said crying way too much. And she was also, you know, both of my actual detectives were just so adamant on how female investigators dress. You know, none of this sexy clothes, none of these tight pants, you know. They're wearing a suit with a baggy jacket because underneath that jacket, you've got pants with a wide belt loop to support a gun, handcuffs, spare magazine, and all the other kind of stuff.
I did have a female agent show up once for an arrest operation wearing high heels and a feather boa. I wish I was making that up. You mentioned beta readers. Like, how many do you have? How do you find them? Do you go for beta readers that are subject matter experts or just people who read the genre? Tell us a little bit about that, because I think it's really important for writers.
Yeah. I mean, I've picked up different beta readers over the years, you know, ones that I really look for, just avid readers. I'm not looking for someone to edit my work. You know, that's why I have a publisher. But someone that reads a lot of the genre and someone that will be bluntly honest with me. I don't need a reader to tell me how great the book is. I want them to tell me where the boring parts are, where they want to start wanting to skip over, where things don't make sense, when I get too deep in the weeds on procedures, when my female character is crying too much, things like that. With my last book, I had one new beta reader who just absolutely turned out great, you know, and as long as she's willing, I'll have her keep on reading forever.
How long does it take you to first draft versus edit a manuscript?
Well, it really depends. I mean, right now I'm my deadline for my next novel is in the future, and so I'm not under pressure. But, you know, when I get in the writing mode, I can finish a first draft in about 3 months, you know, averaging 1,000 words a day. Yeah, so that's what I shoot for. You know, and then I let it sit for a week or two, then I go back into it and rewrite it, which might take a month or two, you know. Then I send it to my beta readers and do another rewrite after that.
You mentioned that you did this on a fictional island. Was that because you didn't want to implicate like a real world police department, or what was the thinking behind that as opposed to putting it in a real place?
You know, that was a large part of it. You know, I want to have some crooked cops there, and I don't want it to be my local police. I want to have murders in all different locations, and, you know, maybe the Westin Hotel on Hilton Head Island would not like the fact that I have a murder, you know, there. And so a fictional place gives me a lot more freedom.
Do you remember the first time, like, what did you had a long career in law enforcement. Did you want to write that entire time and were waiting to retire, or is that something that came later? When did you first want to be a writer?
You know, I never dreamed of writing when I was working. I mean, I was too busy working, you know. I never had time to read for fun, you know. It was all professional reading. And then I retired, and there was a library about a half a mile from where I lived in Connecticut, and I started reading for fun for the first time and got this wild idea that maybe I could write something like that.
That's so interesting that it happened that much later in life for you. Do you remember a specific book that you read that got you excited to maybe do this?
It was one of Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch, you know. I said, you know, hey, you know, for a non-cop, Michael Connelly does a really good job creating a character. But I said, I could do better, you know.
What is it about the process of writing and reading, this sharing of story, that so attracts people to it?
Boy, that's kind of a difficult one, you know. Yeah. I mean, one of the differences between the real world and the stories I write is my detective always gets to solve the case in the end, you know. And that was one thing when I first started writing. I said, you know, I want my detective to always solve the case, something that didn't happen with me, you know, and show the human side of the police officers, you know, because the public quite often doesn't see that. They don't see the stuff that they go through. They don't see their own personal problems, their own demons. Yeah. So that's something I try to bring out in my books.
So humanizing the detectives is a theme, but what are the other themes? Like, what is it you want the reader to take away from these books?
Law enforcement, and especially working homicide, it's more than a job. I mean, it's a calling, you know. It's funny. One of my first murder cases I had, you know, I had a senior partner when I started off, and the first murder I ever had was a dead prostitute found in a schoolyard by the janitor when he showed up for work before the kids came in. And there was, I mean, it's just a body lying there. I have absolutely no witnesses, before the days of video cameras and all that. And I swore that I was going to solve every case when I went to homicide. And my partner, you know, he gave me the first case. He said, this is yours. And, you know, we did all the stuff we're supposed to, got the crime scene people out there. And he goes, you know, we were able to identify the woman. He says, you know, doesn't look like she's got much family. You know, she's got arrest for prostitution, drug use. And he goes, you know, there's only you and I are the only two people in the world that really care about finding out who killed her. And then he said with half joke, and he says, and it's your case. And he says, I'm not even sure I really care. But, you know, it was a joke because we did care, you know, we did care. And even though there was no family, she wasn't loved by everybody out there in the street, we cared. And I think it's that kind of calling, you know, that no matter what, we're going to do what we can to. And sometimes we say we didn't necessarily investigate it for the victim, but we investigated for society. You know, because there's some bad guy out there that committed a murder and he needs to be taken off the street. you can't have a civilization where people are allowed to commit murder and just walk away from it.
So how does that, I mean, so that's a heady responsibility, right? How does that weigh on you psychologically as you're doing it? Because if you don't do it, maybe nobody does it, right? You know, if you don't solve this case, it doesn't get solved. There's no justice for the deceased. There's no justice for whatever family or friends they have. Society as itself is worse off. How does that affect you emotionally as you're investigating it? And then for the ones that you don't solve?
Well, you know, I mean, I spent 6 years working homicide as an investigator. And, you know, quite honestly, at the end of that 6 years, I was totally burned out. You know, I no longer looked forward to sitting in that interview room for 6-7 hours talking to some murder suspect that was denying what he did. You know, I no longer had the drive to go out there and pound on doors, you know, for hours and hours and hours looking for that witness. I was burned out. You know, this was a first marriage. The marriage was falling apart. My health was suffering, you know, all of that kinds of stuff, you know, and I knew it was time for me to leave. And, and unbeknownst to me, then as my career continued, you know, I got promoted to lieutenant and they asked me to come back and command the homicide unit years later. And I was in a different place at that time, a little bit older, a little bit wiser, knowing how to balance life and work a little bit better. You know, and also as a lieutenant, I didn't have to get out of bed in the middle of the night, except on the really big ones or officer involved shootings. So my life was a little more normal than the investigators were.
So from a responsibility or from the weight of the gravity of the work that you're doing, when you're in charge of it all, does that shift because you're really not the one who's trying to solve a specific case? You're trying to provide resources, right? You're trying to take care of the people, run the unit. Was it easier in that respect, or did you feel sort of the weight of the entire unit at that point?
No, you know, that part of it was different. You know, I took over the unit after a previous unit commander had some issues, and so I came into the unit and once I got everybody together and I said, hey, first of all, I no longer care what your clearance rate is. You know, I don't care. I want you to do the right thing. You know, I want you to do your job out there. And if you do your job, the cases that can be solved will be solved. And I made it a point to take care of the investigators. It was a different crew, you know. When I was there as a homicide investigator, probably half the unit were very, very heavy drinkers, you know. And, we spent a lot of time over at the local cop bar, you know, celebrating closures and stuff like that. And this unit was different. It was a new breed. And I brought in some other guys of the new breed. You know, these were the guys that were, they were working all the way through the day and they had a, you know, 2-hour break until, you know, some witness was being brought in. And these guys would go down to the gym and work out for an hour, take a shower, and then come back and go to work, you know? And that was the kind of unit that I wanted, the guys that were able to balance life a little bit more and not put so much pressure on them to solve every case. Because some cases just, you know, unless something magical happens, you can do everything you can and they're just not going to be solved.
Was that physical exercise a substitute for the drinking? Like there has to be some kind of coping mechanism, right? To blow off steam and to talk to people in your unit about what things you've gone through. Was that sort of a one-for-one kind of change over time?
I think it was. And it wasn't everybody that went to the gym. There was probably half the guys that would do that, you know? But yeah, it was a different kind of unit, you know, it was a different mentality, you know, and now I'm kind of the old guy, you know, I mean, here I am in my mid to late 40s and I'm the old guy. I mean, that's the funny thing about police work, you know, I mean, it's, you know, if someone's 10 years older than you, been on the department 10 years longer than you, you think of them as your daddy, you know. I remember when I first went to, when I left homicide, I went back to patrol division as a sergeant. And there I am in my early 40s. And I've got this brand new squad, all basically right out of the academy. And they had a squad party, and, you know, the wives were there. And so I brought my wife and my stepdaughter. And when we're coming home, my stepdaughter says to me, you know, those guys that work for you, they're like more my age than yours.
Yeah.
So, times change as we progress in our careers, I think.
Over these series, do you have your characters growing with time? Do you do real time, or are they just sort of frozen in time for the various books?
Well, you know, that's interesting. When I wrote my first series, because it was taking me, you know, a year between books to write, I had my detective's age a year. And I started having this fear that I was going to become like, you know, Michael Connelly with his Harry Bosch series. And, you know, 30 years later, you know, like Harry Bosch was a Vietnam vet, you know, and, you know, to keep him relevant, he's kind of an old guy. So in my current series, I'm only moving things up 1 month to the next book. So my people really won't age much. And the other exciting thing about that is I can be part of their lives as they're growing and changing, rather than having a year in between where you got to catch up on what's going on.
Oh, that's interesting. When you're writing a series as opposed to standalones like this, how do you deal with like character change and, you know, or like, do you know in advance, like exactly how long these series will be?
Well, you know, when I signed the contract for the series, it was a 4-book series. And, the first book did so well, I mean, so incredibly well right out of the bat, that the publisher contacted my agent and they negotiated an additional 4 books. So now it's an 8-book series. I had a little bit of a trajectory to take place in the first 4 books, you know, my characters as they're growing. And there was, Charlie's father disappeared 10 years before, you know, and of course it was always suspected of being a homicide, but nobody worked it. There's some corruption in the department. And now Sean Tanner has been assigned the case of that missing person. So that continues book after book after book. And of course, since I was just planning for 4 books, it was going to come to a head in book 4, and I'm not sure what's going to happen now. I have to figure it out as I write.
So you're actually going to change what happens to change the character arc because you know you're going longer?
Well, I don't know. You know, I still might have it come to a head in book 4 and, you know, pick up something else that can carry over from book to book to book. You know, there's the bit about the corruption within the sheriff's department. You know, that's something that can carry on. Other characters have things going on in their lives. You know, Sean's daughter, you know, announces she's pregnant in the first book, you know, so, you know, Sean's going to be a granddaddy at some point. And, you know, so those kinds of things. And, you know, as readers will suspect, there might be a little romance going on, you know, a little spark of a romance between Sean and Charlie. You know, how will that progress? So those are things that I get to carry on, you know. As my agent said, you know, that at least half of my readers are going to be women. And they're going to pick up book number 2, not because they want to see what murder Sean and Charlie are going to solve, but they want to see if Sean and Charlie get together.
You know?
So, yeah, I mean, that's true for everybody, right? Having the internal character arcs and change and conflict somehow affecting the external arc. And if people don't care about the characters, they you know, you can only care about the plot so much as you move forward. I've seen authors who do what you're talking about, which is really smart, you know, changing the internal conflict as you go when you have a longer series. And then there's also authors who have very little change. You know, you think of like maybe a Jack Reacher character. There's some, but not a tremendous amount of change in it, because the longer you go, right, you have to have a shallower arc.
Yes. Yeah.
We always ask, it's a writing podcast, so we have to ask this. Are you, how much are you outlining at the beginning versus discovering as you go?
You know, I learned after my first book, which I wrote in my MFA program, that I save a whole lot of time on the keyboard if I plot. My plotting takes me some time. You know, that's where a lot of the creative process occurs for me. You know, I mean, I start off, and to get an idea of where this book is going to go, I sit in my recliner, you know, right behind me in my office here, and with a notepad and index cards, and I jot down ideas, and I jot down, you know, new characters and all this kind of stuff. And then I put it together and I sit down and I do a plot outline so that when I sit down, I know what I'm going to be starting that day. Now, things change as I go along. You know, sometimes they change dramatically. But I always now start with a plot outline. So if I have a book that's 90,000 words, I don't have to type 200,000 words because half of it I delete.
No, I completely understand that, and I do the same thing. You mentioned about 90 days to do a first draft. How long do you spend with this imagining and character creation and playing with it and then actually outlining before you begin that first draft?
Quite often a month or two.
So you're looking at rough, you know, 5 to 6 months to get like that the first one done?
Yeah.
And then how long are you editing after that? Like I've spoken to writers who kind of edit as they go. Do you wait and like plow through that first draft and then edit the whole thing? Or do you edit daily as you go?
No, I start off every day. I read what I wrote the day before. I do a light edit on it and then I move forward.
All right. So are you writing every day during this first drafting process?
I try to, you know, not necessarily, but I try to.
Do you write to a word count or a page count or time?
Usually a time. You know, I shoot for 1,000 words, and some days I write 2,000.
What is the time you give? I'm always curious because there's a wide variety, but I've very few writers that I know are working 8 hours a day. A lot of times it's 3 to 5 hours is sort of a sweet spot.
And that's about it. I don't think I have any more creative energy than that.
How much energy does it take to be creative? Like, I mean, your brain uses a lot of calories, right? Are you exhausted at the end of like a day of creating?
Yeah.
And what do you write in? What software do you use? Do you use a pen and paper? What are you writing in?
Microsoft Word.
Have you ever used Scrivener? I think it's like 90% of authors are using something like that now. It's interesting. Yeah. Do you listen to music while you're creating?
I'm sorry?
Do you listen to music while you're creating?
No, the sounds of silence.
And do you have to write in the same place every day? Is there a comfort in that? Can you write anywhere?
No, I do. I write upstairs in my office. Occasionally when I'm traveling, I write, but not very well.
How important is that writing habit, like for new writers, to have a system and stick with it?
I think that it's very, very important, you know, that sitting your butt in the chair and writing, you know, you gotta write. And if you don't sit your butt in the chair and write, you're never going to get any writing done.
Was there any tips you can give for ways to create that writing process, that writing habit in you? Is there anything that you did that helps with that? Or if someone's having trouble being consistent?
Sit your ass in the chair and write.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. All right, I'm going to end with one final question. I do ask most of my authors this, and it sounds simple, but it really isn't if you think about it. Where do you think story comes from? You're sitting in your recliner back there, and you're coming up with these stories, things that haven't happened in reality. Where is this coming from?
Some weird place in my brain, and I don't necessarily know where.
I think that's one of the most honest answers you can have, right? Like it is a kind of a mystery. So where should viewers go to find your book?
80% of books are sold on Amazon. You know, go on Amazon. You can get it in audio, Kindle, or print. It's not out in every bookstore. You know, some of the local bookstores will have it. You know, but Amazon is the place where people buy everything today. So that's where I would say go.
And you have a writer's website too.
Yes, I do have a website. I'm pretty active on Facebook. You know, I try to do a little bit on Instagram and other things, but, you know, Facebook, probably because of my generation, I feel comfortable there. So I usually try to post something every day. When I have an event coming up, I'll have it on Facebook. I usually try to put some photos afterwards and that kind of stuff.
So book one is out now. When is book two scheduled to launch?
Book number two, A Killer in the Cordgrass, comes out in February next year. Book number three, A Death in the Deluge, comes out in July of next year. And then the fourth book, which we just got a name for, but I can't remember what. The fourth book is going to be A Killing Reputation, then comes out in January of 2027.
Wow. You have got your work cut out for you. Congratulations on the big extended series. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to have you here today. I encourage viewers to go to Amazon and get his book and then rate it for him. It certainly helps with discoverability. So, Brian, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Jeff.